Okay, so here we are. This is chapter 3. Chapter 3 is on growth. This is the second lecture. I'm going to wrap this thing up today. I didn't bring in the Wall Street. I forgot to bring it with me from this morning, but there was a good article on the editorial page about the difference between Keynes and Keynesian economics. And I've mentioned this to you before, that there is a difference. In fact, I mentioned it before, that if Keynes were alive today, he may not be a Keynesian. And the reason I say that is that there's a lot of policies that government has put into place under the name of Keynesian economics that John Maynard Keynes probably would not have agreed with. One thing that this article this morning talks about is the quantitative easing. Now, y'all recall what quantitative easing is? That's when the Federal Reserve creates money and gets that money into the economy, and it does that by mostly buying bonds, securities, bonds, mostly from the federal government, but buys other securities and, in fact, other assets. But the whole point is to create money to get that into the income stream. And that's something that Keynes probably would not, had agreed with. But yet it's done under the name of Keynesian economics. Anyway, there's a good article in the Wall Street about that. I thought that was timely. It was right next to an article that talks about college students and how more American students are going abroad to get their college education because it's sometimes less expensive to get your college education in a foreign country than it is here in America, because it's getting expensive in America. The fact, one of the figures they give in the article is that a four-year, well, the average price of a college is about $30,000 a year. Now here, of course, you know, you're all going to a community college and you're living at home, some of you, and it's a whole, you know, that's the way to go. That's a whole lot less expensive. But if you were to go to a, you know, university and live in a dorm and, you know, pay room and board and all that, you know, it's about $30,000 a year. So you just think about that. A four-year degree, you're already in debt. Well, if you had to borrow the money, you're in debt about $120,000, which is a lot of money. So a lot of young people like yourselves is actually going to other countries, and they can get a college education for a whole lot less money. Anyway, two articles that I found interesting in today's Wall Street. What I'm trying to do is maybe, you know, encourage you to expand your horizons and you know, read things like the Wall Street Journal. Let's get to these slides in chapter 3, which is on growth, which productivity is a big part of it. That's the slideshow, and from current slide. Growth. I used to name this chapter productivity, but I changed the name to growth. But productivity is certainly a key. Oh, that reminds me. I was going to show you a video. That's what I forgot. Let me backtrack a little bit because I got this ready. Now, one of the reasons I show you this video is that in economics, there is something called normative economics and positive economics. And normative economics involves a value judgment where, you know, someone has an opinion about something that, you know, we ought to do this or we ought to do that. See, that's normative economics. Positive economics is more, well, there is no argument here that there are certain principles in economics, and we can make certain statements that are absolutely true, where there's no opinion here. It's just the way it is in terms of mathematics, perhaps. And we spend a lot of our time talking about positive economics, but some of the time, especially when you get into the political arena, there is differences of opinion. And of course, in this book that you know you have as a textbook, I've highlighted the two different opinions, and that does take us into normative economics of the Austrian point of view and the Keynesian point of view. Now, the video I'm going to show you is there are two spokesmen here. One is very much in the Austrian camp, and the other is very much in the Keynesian camp. And this is somewhat of a famous debate between these two people. So I'm not going to show you the whole thing, because the whole thing is 13 minutes, but I'm going to show you enough so you get a flavor of the differences of opinion here.
Or have these two pillars of economic thought faced off on live television. It is time for what we're calling Paul versus Paul. On the one side, Representative Ron Paul has been a pioneer of fiscal conservatism, the face of debt reduction and small government, a hero to the Tea Party. And far on the other side of the spectrum, our guest host, Professor Paul Krugman, a spokesman for activist government, a believer in deficit spending and this generation's voice for economic liberalism. Gentlemen, welcome. We want to get right to the core here of your disagreement. We're going to begin with Congressman Paul. Representative Paul, you know where Professor Krugman stands. What would you say is wrong, or what would you disagree with in terms of his view of government?
Well, he believes in big government from what I read and hear, and I believe in very small government. I emphasize personal liberties. I don't like a managed economy, whether it's through central economic planning or monetary policy or even Congress doing it. So it's a completely different philosophy that markets are supposed to work, in a natural way. I want a natural rate of interest. I don't want the government or the Federal Reserve fixing the rate of interest. That's a price fixing. And wage and price controls never work, so pricing the cost of money doesn't work either. And this idea that somebody or some group might know what the proper amount of money should be or what the proper rate of interest should be is sort of presumptuous. I don't know where they get this knowledge, and Hayek called it a pretense of knowledge. They pretend they know, but they really don't. So when we talk about electing a president or a Congress to run the economy better, they're missing the whole point.
Okay.
Governments aren't supposed to run the economy. The people are supposed to run the economy.
Of course, he did mention Hayek, and hopefully now you know, what that means. Friedrich Hayek, and of course, this is the strictly the Austrian point of view. Correct? All right. Now, keep in mind, this is a point of view. This takes us into normative economics. All right. But we're going to get the other side of it here.
From Professor Krugman, right, with leaving the government out of the equation.
Well, there's certain things. You can't leave the government out of monetary policy. If you try to think, we're going to just let it set itself, it doesn't happen. The government is actually always, the Federal Reserve, the central bank, is always going to be in the business of managing monetary policy. If you think that you can avoid that, you're living in the world that was 150 years ago, right? We have an economy in which money is not just green pieces of paper with faces of dead presidents on them. Money is the result of the financial system. It includes a variety of assets. We're not even quite sure where the line between money and non-money is. It's kind of a continuum. And look, history tells us that, in fact, a completely unmanaged economy is subject to extreme volatility, subject to extreme downturns. I know there's this legend that people like, probably you, Congressman, have that the Great Depression was somehow caused by the government, caused by the Federal Reserve. But it's not true. The reality is that was a market economy run amok, which happened repeatedly over the past couple of centuries. You do need, I'm a believer in the market economy. broadly market economy to be left as free as it can be, but there are limits. You do need the government to step in to stabilize. Depressions are a bad thing for capitalism, and it's the role of the government to make sure that they don't happen, or if they do happen, that they don't last too long.
Congressman Paul, you know, we've been talking a lot about inflation here on the set today, and it's a policy that Professor Krugman is really saying that the Fed should put forward. In other words, we need a little inflation in this economy to get things going. What do you say to that?
Well, inflation is theft. You're stealing value from people who save money. So if you have a 2% or a 10%, the value of the currency is lost. And it really destroys an important feature of the economy, and that is savings. Savings tells us something, and it tells us that capital is available. This notion that capital can come out of the expansion of the money supply is remote. Now, Professor Krugman indicates that we just want to go back 100 years or so. That is not exactly true. We'd like to improve on what it was like back then, but he wants to go back 1,000 years or 2,000 years, just as the Romans and the Greeks and all other countries debased their currency. They didn't have a computer. This idea that we need a Federal Reserve to run things, well, or a central bank, that's just a modern era.
Can you clarify, what do you mean by go back 1,000 years? Is that fair?
What did the Romans do to their currency? The Byzantine Empire had a gold standard for 1,000 years, and they did quite well, and they didn't fight wars. But the Roman Empire eventually destroyed their currency. They put away some price controls before they diluted the metals, they inflated, they thought wealth could come by fooling the people. Who would want today, if they have 10 years to send their kid to college, would they put their money in gold coins or a treasury bill making 1% or 2%? They can't keep up with the inflation or the devaluation of the currency. There would be nothing there.
I am not a defender of the economic policies of the Emperor Diocletian, so let's also make that clear.
What you're defending.
I'm a defender of the economic policies that we followed after World War II that produced the best generation of economic growth that this country has ever experienced. We had a set of policies that provided, there was mild inflation, there was effective government regulation of the financial system, so that it didn't go wild the way it did after we lifted those regulations. We had fiscal policy that stimulated the economy when it was needed. We had policies that fostered a strong middle class instead of using the worship of the supposedly ideal forces of the market to lead to plutocracy. I like the America that my parents prospered in. I think
And there are some reasons for that. Just remember that Friedman, Bernanke apologized to Friedman because the Federal Reserve was responsible for prolonging the agony of the Depression. You have to liquidate the debt. After World War II, a lot of the debt was liquidated. But guess what else we did? The troops were coming home. 10 million people came home.
Well, that gives you an idea. You know, like I said, I didn't want to give you the whole thing, but... just more, reinforcement of the fact that, there are differences of opinion. But let's do get back to... Any questions, by the way, about this debate between, Paul versus Paul? Okay. Let's see. From current slide. All right. So let me start here. Starting the concept of productivity, and I have mentioned this, so a bit of this is a review of last time, because I did talk about what productivity is, but let me repeat it. Productivity is when outputs exceed inputs, or another way of talking about productivity is that if we can produce more per unit of time at a lower per unit cost, then that's what we mean by productivity, or increasing productivity. If we can produce more with fewer inputs, with lower costs, then by definition we have increased productivity. Well, the point though is that what has productivity got to do with growth? And I did talk about this last time also, and the name of the game in the business world, the way to growth and higher profits is to become more efficient by increasing productivity and then to lower prices. The name of the game to succeed in the business world is to lower costs and then to lower prices. And lower prices lead to higher profits because with lower prices, you increase your sales. Now, the best way to be able that you can lower your prices is to lower your costs first. See, that's the key. Lower your costs so that you can lower your price. This is what Henry Ford did, you know, back with the Model T Ford. This is what Sam Walton did with Walmart. This is you know, how people have built very large businesses. You know, Henry Ford, by the way, was not the first one to come out with the automobile. When Henry Ford started to make the Model T Ford, there were many automobile companies already producing cars. But the companies that were producing cars were making them for the wealthy. And what made the Ford Motor Company so successful is that Henry Ford was the first one to make a car priced so the average person could afford to buy it. And we're going to talk exactly how Henry Ford did that, because it's a typical story of how you business person can increase productivity. But Sam Walton was the same way. You know, Sam Walton was always, he would go on vacations with his wife, but he would spend, you know, the whole day going into different retail stores and asking them, well, how do you do this and how do you do that? And he was constantly thinking of ways and asking people and looking for ways how he can increase his productivity, because he knew that if the more he lowered his costs, then the more he could lower his prices, and the more he lowered his prices, then the more units he would sell. Another interesting thing about Sam Walton, by the way, is that one of the ingredients of the success of the Walmart stores is that Sam would always build a store away from his competitors, where his competitors were building stores in the inner city, perhaps. He would go out into the hinterlands where there was not much competition, and that's where he built his stores to begin with. Of course, now that's not the case, but so there's more involved here than just strictly lower cost. There's a technique, anyway, it all leads to growth. That's what this chapter is all about, growth. And remember why growth is important. You know, why is growth so important? Growth is so important because we live in a physical world, and in this physical world, things wear out. Things deteriorate. So if we do not grow, if we don't replace what we have today with something new, then do we have tomorrow what we have today? And the answer is no. We have less tomorrow. If we don't grow, we have less tomorrow and less next week. And year from now, we have a whole lot less. Why? Because every year, every day, things deteriorate and we end up with less and less and less. So we have there is no option. We have to grow. And if we can grow enough, then everyone can benefit. You see, you lower costs, businesses lower costs, and then they lower prices. Lower prices is going to lead to more jobs and a higher standard of living. How does that work? Well, if a business lowers prices, it sells more, people buy more, so the business is going to produce more, and therefore the business needs more resources. And one resource it needs more of is labor. So now we have more jobs generated. And as people are making more income, more people are working, see, they spend money. This leads to an increase in more demand. And so it feeds on itself. You know, success feeds on success. And people buy more, and everyone virtually everyone benefits when we grow enough. The worker, at least everyone can benefit. The worker can get higher wages in real terms, not just money terms. Business gains through higher profits. The government gains through higher tax revenues because of the growth. And so, see, it's a win-win situation for, or can be a win-win situation for everybody. But unfortunately, if we don't grow, then everyone potentially suffers. You know, the business makes less money. There are fewer jobs. Business sells less. There are fewer jobs. And the government takes in less tax revenue. See, everyone loses if we fail to grow sufficiently. Okay? Now, one thing you want to understand is that if we increase productivity, then due to the increase in sales, there is an increase in jobs. But there's a difference in the type of jobs that are generated through an increase in productivity and those types of jobs that may be lost through increases in productivity. Okay? And the kind of jobs that are generated are jobs that require a higher degree of knowledge and skills, education. Because through the process of increase in productivity, as the economy changes, yes, there are more jobs, but the jobs require a higher degree of education. And that's why an education for you all is more important than an education was maybe for your parents, because in your parents' day, when they were your age, it was possible that that you could quit school, you know, from high school, after high school, and go to work for a company and climb the ladder and do very well for yourself if you worked hard enough. Well, that's possible today, but it's less possible than it was in your parents' day. Why? Because the kind of jobs today, even there are more of them due to increases in productivity, they require a higher level of education. So it's more important for you to go to school to acquire that knowledge so that you can qualify for some of these jobs. Okay? Yeah. Yeah.
It's causing people to, you know, have bachelor's degrees and not be able to work either.
Yeah, yeah.
Therefore creating more unemployment.
Yeah. Can you all hear what he said over there? Maybe not. Well, let me repeat it. You know, what he's saying is that, yeah, but what's happening perhaps is that with everyone getting college degrees, there may be not enough jobs to get a college degree, and so we've got a lot of people with high degrees that may be flipping burgers at McDonald's. That's what you're saying, right? And but what I'm saying is that the reason why that is, and that, you know, that is a true today. I mean, it's possible that you could get a degree and still, you know, not do well. The what?
Yeah, you went silent.
You can't hear me?
Oh, yeah, I can.
All right. I got to keep this thing right next to my mouth here. But thanks for letting me know. I encourage you to speak up, right? So thanks. That's the whole point with growth, though, you see. The reason why that's true, why you can get a college degree and maybe, you know, still not get a good job is because, well, we haven't grown enough. If we grew enough, then through that growth, there would be enough jobs for everybody. So the key here is growth. See, but what's happened, and it's very unfortunate for you, is that and something I'm going to talk about really throughout this whole course is that there are many things that have happened that have led to slower growth than perhaps we should have, or a slower growth than what we've had in the past historically. So what happens is that if you have policies that lead to slow growth, and yet you encourage a lot of people to go to college, then you've got a big problem. And that's exactly where we're at today. You know, we have done many, many things, mostly meaning government policies, that have diminished growth. And yet we've encouraged more people to get college degrees, and that's a very bad combination, okay? Especially since a lot of you are borrowing money to go to school. I mean, it's really bad when growth is not sufficient to generate enough jobs and you get college graduates that are $100,000 in debt. I mean, that's really bad. But that unfortunately is becoming more and more common. But that's why this chapter on growth is so important. I mean, that's why growth is so important. And you all ought to favor policies and be active in favoring policies that's going to grow the economy. But if you are not knowledgeable enough and you're not active, then we're going to continue to have policies that are going to lead.
You did it again.
I did it again. Maybe it's my hands. I'll keep my hands down. You can hear me now, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, boy, this thing is sensitive. All right, well, let's move on here. How can consumers buy things at reasonable prices? Okay, competition, whereby lower costs will lead to lower prices and more profit. So I just talked about that. So what is productivity? And I've talked about that. The ratio of a specific measure of output to a specific measure of input. And when does productivity increase? When outputs exceed inputs. All right. How do we increase productivity? Produce more per unit of time at a lower per unit cost. Remember, the terms cost and price are two different things. Cost is what a business pays to produce something. Price is what you and I pay for something at the retail store. Okay, so don't get those two terms mixed up. How do we increase productivity? Through inventions and innovations. And that's what I'm going to talk about next, is exactly how do we increase productivity. If we did away with machines, would more people have jobs? Here's a good question. If some people think that if a tractor, for example, can do the job of 100 people, that if we didn't have the tractor, then 100 more people would have jobs. And that is totally false. And I'm going to show you why here. No workers would be less productive without machines. Let's say that, let me give you a little story to explain this. Let's say that you have a garden that you need plowed, turned up, maybe, a big garden, maybe a quarter of an acre or something. And your neighbor has a tractor and a disc. And so you go over to your neighbor and you say, would you come over and till up my garden for me? And your neighbor says, sure, glad to. And so let's say he comes over and does that, and you give him $50. And let's say it takes him an hour to till up your garden. And it's really no big deal on his part. I mean, he just sits on the tractor and he steers it and the tractor does the work, and he does, this quarter acre and maybe an hour, and you give him $50, and so that's that. Now, next year, let's say you need your garden plowed up again, and you go to your neighbor, and you say, you know, would you come over and plow up my garden for me? And your neighbor says, well, yeah, I'd love to, except the fact, you know, I sold my tractor. But don't despair. That's all right. You know, I have a shovel and a rake, and I'll come over and I'll work up your garden with a shovel and a rake. And then your neighbor says, now, if I recall, last year you paid me $50 an hour. And I figured that, you know, with the tractor I could do it in an hour. But with a shovel and a rake, it may take me, I don't know, how many hours? You know, it may take me 25, 30, you know, 50 hours. So I'll come over and I'll do this hard work, because it's hard work if it with a shovel and a rake. And, you know, it may take me 20, 25 hours, and you give me $50 an hour, and we'll call it a deal. And so what are you going to say? Well, you're going to say, well, heck no. I mean, that would cost me a fortune. I mean, I can go out and buy a lot of vegetables with no work, you know, with that kind of money. And so so you say to your neighbor, no, you totally misunderstood me. Last year I wasn't paying you by the hour. Last year I was paying you by the job. So you come on over and you put in your 20, 25, 30 hours, and I'll give you $50. Now, what's your neighbor going to say? Well, I'm not going to go and do that hard work under a hot sun for, you know, 25 hours for a mere $50. And so here's the point. The point is this. Despite the fact that a tractor can do the job of you know, multiple people, 100 people, let's say, the fact is that with the tractor, the buyer and seller could come to an agreement on terms of the job. And so there was a job. But without the tractor, the buyer and seller are too far apart. They can't come to an agreement. And therefore, there is no job. You see how that works? Because of the tractor, because of the invention, the machine, there is a job. But without the machine, then there would be no job. And that's just the way things work. Let me give you another story. Let's say that we've got three factories. And let's say each factory employs 200 people. And each of these three factories takes on labor-saving machines. They automate. And these machines can do the job of 100 people. So each of these three factories lays off 100 people. So we got 300 people here that have lost their jobs. Now, what does it look like is happening? Well, what it looks like is happening is that the machines are replacing jobs. And you would think that, well, the more machines we have, because those machines can do the work of multiple people, then the more unemployment we would have. It sounds this way, right? Now, how do you tell truth from untruth? Well, you tell truth from untruth by observing. I mean, if I tell you that it's raining, how do you know if I'm telling the truth or not? Well, you go and look out the window, right? If it's raining, I'm telling the truth. If the sun is shining, I'm not telling the truth. Well, this is the same way. I mean, how do we know what truth is or untruth is in economics? Well, we simply observe. Now, if machines replace people on the job, then which countries of the world would have the highest unemployment rates? Well, it would be your industrialized countries that would have the highest unemployment rates, because they are the ones who have automated the most, correct? Well, if we look around the world and we look at those countries that have automated in the past and other countries that have not, which countries have historically been closer to full employment? And the answer is those countries that have automated. You know, take India, I'll use an example of India and Japan. Both India and Japan in the past have manufactured
cloth, you know, the weaving. They've been big in the weaving industry. But for many years, and I don't think this is true anymore, but for many years in India, you had what is called a cottage industry in the weaving business. Now, what a cottage industry is that people may have had a loom in the back room of their house, and they would weave. And after they made the cloth, they would bring it to, you know, they would either sell it, or maybe they were employed by, you know, a business. And so they would bring it, you know, back to the business so that the cloth could be sold and that they could, earn an income. But that's called a cottage industry, okay? And this is the way cloth was made for many years in India. And India discouraged automation. Because India believed that, well, you know, if we automate, and since machines replace people on the job, then there's a lot of these people in this cottage industry that are going to lose their jobs. So if we pass laws against automation, then these people will keep their jobs. All right? Now, let's look at Japan. Japan, at the same time, had a totally different viewpoint. Japan was thinking, you know, if we can automate, we can, you know, replace people with machines, that our costs will go down. And in fact, these machines can really do things that a human being can't do. I mean, the machine can maybe make intricate designs on fabric that, you know, someone with just a sewing machine would be unable to do. So Japan said, well, look, you know, we'll automate as much as we can, and we'll lower our costs, and we'll produce a better product than, let's say, India. All right, now here's you and I in America. And we're looking around the world, and we're saying, you know, now where can we buy the best cloth at the lowest possible price? Now, we look at India. Here, you know, India, you know, they don't have the fancy designs. Their prices are a lot higher because their costs were higher. Japan's prices are lower. It's a better cloth. So where are we going to buy our cloth, from India or Japan? Well, the world says, well, let's buy from Japan. Now, if the world buys more and more from Japan and fewer buy from India, more money flows into Japan, less money flows into India, and what happens? Well, we got plenty of jobs in Japan, and we have unemployment in India. Now, that is why it's so important to know truth from untruth. See, if you believe that automation replaces people on the job, then that's not true. And because you acted on a falsehood, you end up with more unemployment, you see, and possibly poverty and misery. But if you know truth, and you know that automation generates many, many more jobs than it replaces, and you act on that truth, then you are rewarded with full employment and more prosperity. Now let's get back to these three factories. All right, we got three factories. Each of them automate, each of them lay off 100 people. Now what does it look like is happening? What it looks like is happening, and indeed it is happening, is that we got 300 people here that have lost their jobs, and that these jobs may be gone and gone forever. But what have we done wrong in our analysis? Well, we have looked at it in a micro sense rather than a macro sense. See, if you look at that, even that town, you look at those three factories, well, yeah, you've got 300 people have lost their jobs. That's true, all right? But if you look at it in a macro sense, and what's the name of this course? Macroeconomics. See, we're trying to look at things in the large. We're trying to look at, you know, above and looking down, and we're trying to see how everything fits together. Now, what happens here is that, yeah, okay, we got 300 jobs lost in this town, let's say. But if companies are automating, that's going to lead to lower costs. That's why they did. I mean, why does a business automate? I mean, would a business take on labor-saving machines if those machines did the same job at higher costs than with employees? No, I mean, a business owner is only going to automate if those machines lower costs, right? I mean, that's the whole purpose here. So if we automate more, then costs will go down, because that's why we automate it, right? Costs will go down, and in order to increase profits, what does a company do after they've lowered costs? They lower prices, because that's the way for higher profits. And with those lower prices, in a macro sense, you and I, consumers, buy more. Business, therefore, sells more. And therefore, business needs more. Eventually, they need more workers. So for maybe in this town, we've lost 300 jobs, and those jobs can be gone and gone forever. But out there in the larger economy, we might have 3,000 jobs generated. Now, what's one of the problems with this? Well, one of the problems in terms of policy is that we can identify those 300 people that have lost their jobs. You know, John Doe, you know, lives on Elm Avenue. He has got 3 young children. See, he has lost his job. I mean, you know, we can identify him. But if we lay off those 300 people, we may have generated 3,000 jobs in the macro sense, but who are those people that now have jobs that would not have jobs otherwise? Well, we don't know who they are. We do know they exist, because that's the way the system works. You know, you lower prices, people will buy more, business will sell more, and businesses will need more employees. But the point you make is right. The employees that business needs because of the automation require a higher degree of skill and knowledge and education. See, in fact, we have something that economists call structural unemployment. Now, here's another thing. All right, I said that we've got 3 factories. Each factory lays off 100 people. We got 300 people now who are unemployed. But that automation generated, let's say, 3,000 additional jobs. Now, did I say that we've got 3,000 more people working now? And I didn't say that. So I didn't say that they were working. I said that we had 3,000 jobs generated, because there's something that is called structural unemployment. Now, what is structural unemployment? Well, that means that the economy can change structurally, and as a result, we get more unemployment. Okay, and automation can do this. See, if you automate, yeah, you generate more jobs, but the problem could be to match the workforce with the job market. See, so what is really the problem here? Well, the problem isn't that we've automated. The problem is education. The problem is that maybe the workforce has not kept up with the changes so that they can qualify for all these jobs that are being generated. But society has done many things to try to minimize structural unemployment. And New River Community College is a prime example. See, you, why is it that, see, this course that you're taking now, you know, Principles of Macroeconomics, you know, it'll transfer to any, you know, four-year school as Principles of Economics credit. But if you were to go to Radford or Tech and take the same course, it would cost you three times as much. Now, why can you take the same course here for a third the money as you would pay at Radford and Tech? And one reason, a big reason, is that your tuition, the cost of your education is more highly subsidized by the state of Virginia here at a community college than it is at a four-year university. The community college student gets more subsidies, a higher rate of subsidy, than a student that goes to a four-year school. You see, no student pays the full cost of their of your education. I mean, if you were to pay the full cost, I mean, if you were to say, okay, you know, you're coming to college, you're taking all these courses, I mean, if you were to bear the full cost of your education, most of you wouldn't be here. See, the fact is that you're the cost of your education is highly subsidized by government. So you don't pay the full price of coming to college. Now, why does the state and the federal government, why is education so highly subsidized? In fact, you can go through the 12th grade and it's totally free, right? Well, I mean, you know, that, you know, for one student to go through from first grade to 12th grade, that's very expensive. And yet, each student doesn't pay for it. Of course, what happens with that is that people pay property taxes, and through those property taxes, they pay for their local education. That's basically how, you know, grade school and high school is paid for. But the individual doesn't pay. Well, why does society subsidize education? And the answer is because that is the answer to structural unemployment. See, growth, what's the key to growth? Increased productivity through inventions and innovations. What does that do? Well, that could lead to structural unemployment. So what is the solution to structural unemployment? To subsidize education. See, if we can subsidize, we can pay a part of the cost of your education, then you can come to college, acquire the knowledge and skills, and if the economy has grown enough, when you graduate, there will be higher-paying jobs. And you will make higher-paying jobs because of you have increased your value. You've increased your worth because you have a greater knowledge and skills by going to college than you would by not going to college. And in a healthy economy, then you are rewarded for your effort. See, you will be rewarded for your effort provided that we grow the economy sufficiently. And that's why this chapter on growth is so central to your understanding of how the world works. Okay? Remember, I talked about this before, and because so much of, you know, these principles and concepts require repetition. Remember I talked to you several weeks ago about is it cheaper for an American company to produce here in America and pay, let's say, $25 an hour? Or is it cheaper to go to some place like Mexico, some foreign country, and pay workers to produce the same thing, but only pay them maybe $5 an hour? So which is cheaper? Pay an American worker $25 an hour to produce a widget, let's say, or to go to countries like Mexico and pay a Mexican worker $5 an hour to manufacture a widget? And the answer is, well, maybe that American that's making five times as much per hour is less expensive. Now, how can we say that to pay someone $25 an hour is less expensive than paying someone $5 an hour? And the answer is because you've got to consider output as well as input, right? I mean, if I say, okay, we pay the American worker $25 an hour, well, that's input. You know, okay, we're paying them. That's input. The Mexican worker, $5 an hour. Well, that's input. But what's output? Yeah, how much do they produce? See, that's the key. I mean, if the American worker that we pay $25 an hour to, if he can produce something in an hour that has a market value of, let's say, $100, that he produces something in an hour that can be sold in the marketplace for $100, then for every $1 we pay him, we're getting $4 back. See, we pay him $25, but we're getting $100 when we sell that product that he produced. But if you go, let's say, to Mexico, because of their lower, perhaps because of their lower productivity, all right, maybe that Mexican worker can produce something in an hour that only has a value of $10. So we pay him $5. He produces something that, you know, worth, and we sell it in the marketplace for $10. So for every $1 we pay him, we get $2 back. Well, would you rather pay someone $1 and get $5 back, or pay someone $1 and get $2 back? Well, that's a no-brainer, right? See, the American worker, when you look at it in terms of inputs and outputs, the American worker is less expensive on a per-unit basis. And that's what counts here, on a per-unit basis, than the, let's say, the Mexican worker. So what we're doing here, you know, for the second half of this chapter is that what we're looking at is, okay, since, you know, that is a truism, it is a truism that if we increase productivity enough, if we grow the economy enough because we've increased productivity, then, you know, eventually everyone benefits. Well, then the question is, well, how do we do that? How do we increase productivity? And the answer is through inventions and or innovations. And that's, you know, what I'm going to talk about here is, you know, how do inventions increase productivity? How do innovations? Innovation, by the way, is a new way of doing something. Okay, an invention is a new machine or a new tool. An innovation is a new way of doing something. Okay, I may have gotten ahead of myself. I normally do on these slides. Let's see where these slides take us. Does automation lead to unemployment? No. The more machines we have, the more jobs we have. Okay, so I would explain that in terms of, India and Japan. Why does an increase in productivity lead to economic growth? And I've talked about this, right? Lower costs, lower prices, increased sales, more growth. What factors lead to an increase in productivity? Inventions. More and better capital. Now, what is capital? Remember what that is. Capital are the machines and tools used in the productive process, right? A hammer in the hands of a carpenter is capital. A hammer that you have at home is not capital, even though it could be the same hammer, because capital are the machines and tools that are used in the productive process. Okay, so what factors lead to an increase in productivity? Inventions, for example, better capital, better machines. Growth in human capital. Now, what's human capital? Human capital are the skills and knowledge that people need to work with capital. And that's what we specialize here at New River, right? We specialize in human capital. That we have all these machines, we've got these inventions, you know, computers and all, but it takes skills to operate these machines. And so that's what we specialize in at New River, okay? Human capital. And innovations and economies of scale I'm going to talk about, and a mobile labor force. The economies of scale says that as a company grows, then there are many avenues whereby that company can lower their costs. You know, as a company grows, you know, for example, one reason why Walmart can underprice their competitors is that they grew to a certain large size that Walmart can buy from their wholesalers in bulk. You know, when you buy large quantities from somebody, then you can pay less money per unit, and they can still make a lot of money. Okay, if you buy a small quantity from someone, well, that someone may need a much higher price to make it worth their while. But if you're buying large quantities, that person may make a little bit of money in each unit, but their total profit may be very high because you bought in such large quantities. So as Walmart grew, it experienced what are called economies of scale, meaning that there were many things that happened that whereby Walmart was able to lower their costs. See, they took advantage of their larger size over their competitors. They were able to lower costs, and therefore this led to increase in productivity. Now, a mobile labor force is very important in terms of increase in productivity. Because, you see, the only thing that we can depend upon in life is change. Change is inevitable. The only thing that we know about tomorrow is that things are going to be different than today. All right? That's just a fact of life. Now, because change is inevitable, okay, because change is inevitable, then as things change, the job market changes. And as the job market changes, we need a mobile labor force so that people can move to where the jobs are. You know, if we have one area of the country, let's say, that's experiencing more unemployment, but another area of the country that's experiencing more employment, then the people from the impoverished area should be able to move to the area where there are more jobs. And that's called labor mobility. Now, this is something that has been a drag on the American economy because of the mortgage market. See, the government for years has believed that because a part of the American dream is to own your own home, they have passed legislation and taken actions to encourage people to buy instead of rent. Now, purchasing a home has many advantages, but one disadvantage to owning a home is that it limits labor mobility. Okay? This is common, right? You get a job and you think, well, this is a great job and you're making, you know, some good income. And so you buy a home, you know, you take out a mortgage, and now you've got, you know, maybe a big mortgage, which is okay because you're, you know, making good money. But next thing you know, things change, and all of a sudden, you don't have a job. Now, you can get a job maybe in the next state or across country, but what's the problem? Yeah, the problem is maybe you're even upside down in your mortgage, which is common. You know, maybe you owe more on the house than what the house is worth on the market. So now you're stuck. I mean, if you move, well, you still got house payments to make in a house you're not even living in. And, you know, maybe you can rent it, maybe not. If you do rent it, maybe the rent will cover the full cost, and maybe it won't, right? Or you can, if you sell the house, well, maybe you owe $150,000 on the house, but maybe you can only sell the house for maybe $100,000. So you could sell your house, but you'd still owe the bank $50,000. So what does that do? I mean, when a lot of the workforce, are paying on a mortgage on a house, and a lot of them, due to economic circumstances, end up being upside down on their mortgage, what does that do to labor mobility? It diminishes labor mobility, and it diminishes productivity. That's bad for the individual, but it's also bad for the economy. So what is an innovation? A new way of doing something. And a good example of an innovation, which takes us to the specialization of labor, focusing on individuals' efforts on a particular product or a single task. It's an old example, but it's still a very good one, is Henry Ford and the assembly line. I mean, if you mention Henry Ford and the Ford automobile, you know, most people would say, oh yeah, you know, he became successful because of the assembly line. Now remember, Henry Ford was not the first one to produce a car, but he was the first one to produce a car that the average income person could afford to buy. So what did Henry Ford do? Well, one of the things Henry Ford did is that he adopted the assembly line technique into the automobile industry. Whereas other automobile manufacturers at the time used the skilled craftsman technique of production. Now, with the skilled craftsman technique, you might have two or three men that would act as a team, and they would assemble an entire automobile. Now, we call this the skilled craftsman technique of production because if you were one of three that were going to assemble an entire automobile, you would have to know a lot about that automobile, all right? That's why we call this the skilled craftsman technique. So let me give you an example of the skilled craftsman technique. Let's say that I'm one of these skilled craftsmen and, I'm assembling an automobile. And, my first job was to put on the left fender, and I put on the left fender, and my next job was to put on the right fender. Well, over in the next room is a big stack of right fenders. So I walk over and pick out a right fender. And on the way back, I'm thirsty, and I pass a drinking fountain, so I get a drink of water, and I might pass a colleague, and I say a few words, say, hi, how are you, how's the family, and like that. And then, I get back to the automobile, and maybe I forgot where I put my wrench, so it takes me a few minutes to find my wrench, and finally, I get to work, and I put on the right fender, and then maybe my next job is to put on the front grill, and then I got to go over and, retrieve a front grill, and then I come back, and, well, that's how it was done. When Henry Ford came on the scene, there were many, many automobile manufacturers, but they were all using this skilled craftsman technique. Now, what happens here is that we have a lot of unproductive activity going on. Let's say we pay a worker, a dollar an hour to keep it simple, and let's say that he works an 8-hour day, but let's say that 4 hours of that day were productive with the hands-on automobile, but the other 4 hours was taken up in non-productive activity, like walking, retrieving parts, getting a drink of water, talking to friends, looking for misplaced tools. See, I mean, we have a lot of unproductive activity here. So let's say that a person in 8 hours with the skilled craftsman technique can make one car a day. Now, when I say one car, if three people are working as a team and those three people can manufacture three cars, then that one person is responsible for one car, correct? Now, what have we got here? We're paying them $1 an hour. We're paying them for 8 hours, but only 4 of those hours are productive because the other 4 are unproductive. Okay, now y'all with me on this so far? All right, now let's take Henry Ford and the assembly line. Henry Ford gets the idea that, well, you know, instead of doing it with the skilled craftsman technique, you know, let's put 100 men in a line. Let's have a car on, you know, just the chassis and wheels. And we'll hire, you know, these big burly guys with a rope. You know, they'll tie a rope to the front. And they'll pull this frame along the factory floor, you know, along the line where 100 men are stationed. And each man along the way will have one simple task. Now, let's say I'm a person with the assembly line, and my task is to put in a bolt into the fender as the car passes by me. And I got a big bin of bolts to my side, and one car, I put a bolt in as the car passes by. And I turn around and pick up another bolt, and by that time there's a second car in front of me, so I put a bolt in that, and I turn around and pick up a third bolt, and you know, now there's a third car in front of me, so I put a bolt in that fender. Now, if I did this 8 hours a day, how much of my day is taken up with walking, with getting a drink of water, with talking to friends, with looking for misplaced tools? See, none of my time is taken up with those unproductive activities. So would you agree with me that it would be possible for me to be productive 8 hours a day? Now, that wouldn't be, you know, perfectly true. I mean, there's always lunch hour, and there's, or at least a lunch break, and you know, things don't work out exactly. But, I mean, generally speaking, see, what have we done with the assembly line? What we've done, essentially, is that we've eliminated non-productive activity so that more of a worker's time is spent with productive tasks. Okay? Now, let's say that with this assembly line worker, we pay him $1 an hour, just like with the skilled craftsman. But if the skilled craftsman can make one car a day, working 4 hours, how many cars a day should the assembly line worker make? 2 cars. Now, again, if you've got 100 people, and those 100 people make 200 cars a day, then what's the contribution for each person? 2 cars. So you got this assembly line worker that, because he's working 8 hours a day productively, he should be able to make 2 cars, at least that should be his contribution. He should be able to make 2 cars compared to the 1 car for the skilled craftsman. Well, we paid them both $8 a day. So what's happened here? Well, what's happened is that our costs for the assembly line worker has been cut in half, right? We're getting 2 cars for the same wages as 1 car with the skilled craftsman technique. And that's the key. That's the key. It's not the only reason, by the way, but that's an important reason why the assembly line, why dividing up the labor increases productivity. Because when we can divide up the labor, we eliminate non-productive activity. All right? Now, was Henry Ford the originator of the assembly line? No, he wasn't. In fact, if you read Adam Smith's book, The Wealth of Nations, you know, going back, way back to 1776, the first chapter, he talks about of the division of labor. That's the name of the first chapter in The Wealth of Nations, of the division of labor. And what Adam Smith talks about way back in 1776, in the first chapter, right there in the first paragraph, is he talks about how dividing up the labor increases productivity and how that increase in productivity can lead to economic growth. Now, what he uses back as his example is a pin factory near his hometown of Glasgow, Scotland. You know, he was Scottish, and there was a pin factory near his hometown in Glasgow, and they used the assembly line to produce straight pins. And he goes into great detail of how, by dividing up the labor, this pin factory greatly increased productivity, which enabled this pin factory to sell their pins at low prices and in order to increase their profits. So see, all this talk I've been giving you about how automation leads to, you know, to more jobs that it replaces, well, you could have read that way back in the 1700s if you just read Adam Smith. So it's not a new concept at all, but it's a truism. Now, there are other things, by the way, that Henry Ford did that was kind of interesting. You know, Henry Ford was famous for saying that his customers could have any color car they wanted, provided that color was black. See, I mean, if you look at an old Model T Ford, well, what color is it? Well, they're all black. Well, why did Henry Ford paint all his cars black? Because it was less expensive to paint everything the same color than to use different colors. I mean, if you're going to paint, you know, your cars different colors, well, you need, you know, two paint rooms and paint brushes and, you know, this and that. I mean, it's a lot more complicated. But if you say, hey, let's just paint everything the same color, and it didn't have to be black. There's nothing special about black. I mean, he could have painted all his cars pink, and it would have had the same effect. I mean, the point is if you paint all your cars the same color, you simplify the painting process, and by that simplification, you lower your costs. You become more efficient. You know, Henry Ford was the originator of the standardized part. You know, before Henry Ford, the automobile companies, you know, they would use specialized parts. And, I'm running out of time, aren't I? Gosh. Well, let me just finish this up, then we'll call it a day. Boy, that time really flew by. I didn't realize it. But they used specialized parts where Henry Ford standardized his parts, so he used the same, like the same steering wheel in all his cars, or the same running boards in all his cars, and this lowered his costs. He was the first one to come out with the concept of the 8-hour day. Why is the 8-hour day the standard work day? There's only one reason, because 3 times 8 equals 24. Yeah, 3 shifts instead of 2. You know, in Henry Ford's day, the average factory worked 2 hours of 9 hours apiece, which meant that their factories lied idle for 6 hours a day, where there were fixed costs but no money coming in. And Henry Ford said, well, look, let's go to 8 hours a day, run 3 shifts, and that way our factories are not going to lie idle where we have costs and we're not making money. All right? Well, anyway, that's a good place to stop. Yeah, responsible for the night shift, yeah. Anyway, let's call it a day. And so what are y'all going to do for next time? Read chapter 4, right? So I'll see you all next time.